Hi, David Brancaccio here. Thanks for listening to this special edition of the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. All this year, we're looking back at the 2008 financial crisis, taking stock 10 years later of its impact on our lives for our project that we call Divided Decade. Now, two of the names most closely associated with the cleanup and the names on the very law meant to shore up the system against a future crisis are Dodd and Frank. Congressman Barney Frank and Senator Chris Dodd, both Democrats and both now retired from office, didn't just co-author the famous Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010. They were also instrumental in helping to pass the Troubled Asset Relief Program, known by the acronym TARP, but most call it the bailout. It was the authorization to use $700 billion of taxpayer money to save several failing institutions dubbed too big to fail, all in an effort to save the economy from crumbling into another Great Depression. Now, I recently sat down with Senator Dodd and Congressman Frank at the National Press Club in Washington for an in-depth conversation that started with the economic calculations and the political calculus that went into passing the bailout, and the political and economic fallout that happened as a result. Here's part one of our conversation. Senator Chris Dodd, Congressman Bonnie Frank, thanks for joining us.
Welcome.
All right, let's just get into the mindset of back then 10 years ago. Each of you, I think, has long and repeated experience dealing with emergencies, but when and where did it become clear to you that you were fighting the worst financial crisis in generations?
Well, I think it was like beginning of 06. I mean, why don't we talk about the crisis of 08? But really, contrary to what people think, this was not a secret, the housing bubble. And as early as 06, in fact, Jack Reed, Senator Reed of Rhode Island, and Jim Bunning, of all people, Bunning chaired the subcommittee dealing with housing. And they had hearings in 06 on the growing problem of the housing bubble. But it wasn't really until 07, into 07. And then it was Bear Stearns, which really kind of blew things up. But there was a lot of, we had 90 hearings in the Senate in 07 on the housing crisis coming along. 90 hearings, a lot of hearings. So we were very much aware the problem was growing.
And you have years and years, Congressman, in dealing with housing issues. You were tracking this too, right?
Yeah, and Chris is right. We were on to the housing thing. In fact, in my first year as the chairman of the committee, 2007, when the Democrats took over, we actually passed a bill that would have shut down the bad housing, and it was Republican opposition meant you couldn't break a filibuster in the Senate. But actually, there's this conservative myth that the problem was that liberals were pushing to put poor people into housing, and that's what caused the problem. The exact opposite is the case. Beginning in 94, Congress passed a bill, the last time the Democrats had control until back to 2007, which mandated the Federal Reserve to restrict that. Alan Greenspan refused to do it. Greenspan said, no, I believe in the market.
This is in the 1990s, right? He got the power to do this.
In 1994. And then in the late 90s, a number of states began to do this because the federal government wasn't. And the Bush administration used the federal power of preemption and canceled the ability of states to do it. So then when the Democrats get control, there are hearings, as Chris mentioned, that he's holding. We actually pass a bill. The Republicans are still against it. The Wall Street Journal, now I love this, in November of 2007, the Wall Street Journal attacked me by name because we were trying to restrict subprime loans. And they said, why doesn't he want poor people and people and minorities to take over? So, but I will say this. I think we saw it as a housing issue. We didn't see how much it was going to spread. But then Chris is exactly right. When Bear Stearns had to be taken over, that was a sign that this had spread beyond housing.
And then in the fall, you get Lehman. But is there a meeting where Treasury comes over and says, no, this is happening now. It's starting to fall apart?
Well, during the summer, I would get phone calls on Friday afternoon from Paulson generally after the markets had closed. Sort of, we got this problem. Remember, there was a problem where Citicorp was a problem. And then there was a problem where Wachovia was a problem, and they had Wachovia be taken over by Wells Fargo, and then there was Merrill Lynch, and that was taken over by Bank of America. There was a series of potential failures, and they found some way to resolve it, starting with Bear Stearns, but then came Lehman, and there was nobody left to resolve it with, and but we saw this building up.
Well, we did, but let's just say, the administration was slow. I mean, the idea that it was one ant in the kitchen, I mean, this is somehow that this was a one-off problem and that it wasn't a systemic problem.
This is the late George W. Bush administration at that moment.
Yeah, you know, he's very unpopular and leaving office. And so made it difficult. But that was Hank and Paulson. Look, he came out of Goldman Sachs, very knowledgeable, smart, not a Washington person. And so it was uncomfortable, I think, in many ways with the politics of the town, in a sense, and wanted to keep the ball in the air, be positive, and this was all going to work out, and positive statements, when in fact it was going the opposite
direction. I had a somewhat different reaction to Paulson. And you're right to mention Bush. I mean, the problem is I think Paulson did begin, and Bernanke, to see this, although they, you know, Bernanke had earlier said, he acknowledged that, oh, this is housing, it's not going to spill over. But I think they began to see that this could be more of a problem. Certainly they were telling me they were worried they didn't have the tools. But you had this very conservative administration. And by the way, when Bernanke and Paulson did intervene to keep Bear Stearns from failing and had J.P. Morgan Chase take it over, the Republicans on the committee that I chaired, very, very conservative, wanted me to have hearings so they could denounce Paulson and Bernanke for their intervention. I wouldn't have the hearings. I didn't think that was going to be kind of useful.
Who, by the way, is working fairly fluidly with his president, with their president, who's a Republican, nonetheless.
But this was the tension that Paulson faced, which was, you know, the Republican Party was so was so resistant. And I do think they were, you know, they had a series of, well, we'll fix this, we'll fix that. Paulson and Bernanke were saying to me, at least, well, we would like to have a better set of tools. And I think in the end, though, you know, they had J.P. Morgan Chase take over one, and Bank of America took over another, and Wells Fargo took over another. And then came Lehman, and there was nobody left to take it over.
Did you have the right resume to have to deal with this? Did you have the right qualifications and expertise to do this kind of work?
Well, probably no one did, in the sense we were dealing with a set of issues and problems that hadn't surfaced. Obviously, the industry had become far more sophisticated, outstripped the capacity of the regulators and rulemaking. And I think, you know, Paulson's correct, and Bernanke in the sense that the tool chest was not not keeping pace with the kind of issues that we're confronting all the time. And the issue of financial literacy, I've often said, is not only a general problem with the public at large, but you could make the case for the Congress itself. And all of a sudden, dealing with issues, dealing in the derivatives area, for instance, which might as well have been in Latin or Greek as well as in English. So there was that gap. But there were talented people. As I mentioned, we had 90-some-odd hearings in 07, not to mention 08, and a lot of very talented people coming up and warning about the problems, and they were being ridiculed. I remember one guy came up and said there could be as many as 1 million foreclosures, and he was accused of exaggerating, and he was. He's exaggerating in the sense of the size. It was more like 5 million.
It was more like 5 million. Yeah, Did you feel you're in over your head at any point in all this?
I felt I was being, I wouldn't feel, I was being pushed. I mean, you mentioned my interest in housing. I got on this committee, it was then called the Banking Committee, because I cared about housing. And when I became chairman, I thought, well, now we can really do something about affordable housing. And, you know, by necessity, you had to deal with this. No, I had to do a lot of learning. You know, the these things, derivative, were deliberately somewhat obfuscatory. And, I almost felt like the teacher who's teaching a subject that's new and you're a day ahead of the class. I mean, the night before you teach the class, you've got to go read the lesson, and there's a lot of learning there. And of course, you realize how much you pick up, because my husband is a surfer, not somebody who had previously been involved in this, but he was the East Coast surfer most knowledgeable about credit default swaps that they'd ever met.
He did the crash course as well. So look, back in the TARP days, in that fall of 2008 after Lehman, you're working hard on a response. But what's your biggest regret from that period? I know, for instance...
Well, for me, it's easy. We did write into it explicitly the authority to use some of the TARP money for foreclosures. And what happened was Paulson decided he needed to use the first 350. Well, here's the dilemma we had, Chris Dodd, myself, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid. You know, it's part of the problem of being a Democrat. We believe in government. We believe government has a major role. And we're not ready to see things crash because the people we most care about are going to be hurt. People said, oh, you just bailed out the bankers. Jamie Dimon wasn't going to be hurting. He didn't have to go to the ATM. He had enough money put away. It's the working people who were going to be hurt. And so We had to give them the tools, knowing that we couldn't wield them ourselves, but the alternative would have been worse. And one of the problems we had was we told him to do something about foreclosure, and he refused to do it, and that was my most serious regret.
Well, it was, you know, people have forgotten this, but we had the meeting on September 18th, which, of course, was that incredible gathering where Ben Bernanke says, and I'm quoting him almost exactly here, unless you act, speaking to the congressional leadership, Bonnie and I in the room, in the matter of days, the entire financial system of this country and a good part of the world will melt down. Needless to say, the oxygen left the room in Nancy Pelosi's conference room that night. Within a matter of a couple of days, two or three days, at 1:30 in the morning, received a bill. And it was 2.5 pages long, said, give me $700 billion, no court, no regulator can intervene. I got the call at 6:30 in the morning from staff saying, you can't imagine. Imagine Barney and I trying to pass that, the thing. So it began then the negotiations on a bill, which turned out to be about 100 pages long. But we did a number of things in there. And Barney's absolutely correct. They were not enthusiastic about it. In fairness to them, they were worried that the banks would not participate. But assistance on foreclosure, the warrants, which made us billions of dollars for the taxpayer ultimately.
In the end.
Yeah, but people don't remember that at all. Tranches, we didn't vote all at once. It was done in parts so you could actually judge it. Put a GAO resident in the process, a congressional committee of oversight along the way. And the point that Barney just made, I talked to Steve Rattner last night, had we not done what we did beyond the banks, and allowed for some of those monies to be used in other economic areas, Chrysler and GM would have failed.
That's an interesting point. So this financier, famous Steve Rattner, yeah. His point is that if you got the homeowner's mortgage relief, it might have impinged on
some of that money could be used
rescue.
For other things, yeah.
And no, he wasn't complaining about it.
No.
We wrote it somewhat more broadly, and the way we wrote it was what allowed them to keep General Motors and Chrysler in business. That came out of the TARP.
Yeah, that's part of that. That was part of the negotiation of putting that package way beyond, give me 750.
Oh, I see. You're saying, look, you didn't have $2 trillion. You had $700 billion you were working with,
right.
And it had to be allocated. Yeah. You tried on mortgages.
And Chris mentioned the tranches. So the first tranche, which is a fancy congressional word for half, was $350 billion. And we said, you got to use this. I mean, I had a hearing to waiving the bill at Paulson, and the problem was, you know, Maxine Waters and I, we had to get this bill through the House. Getting it through the House was harder because Chris had a more responsible set of Republicans to work with.
Only one-third were up. 100% of the House is up.
That's a good point. So we had to really work hard to get this through, and to get the Democrats to support it, Maxine Waters and I stressed that we had foreclosure relief. And then Paulson gets the $350, and I was generally worked well with him and think highly of what he did in general, but I disagreed sharply here. He refused to use any of the first $350 for mortgage foreclosure relief, saying, I need it all to keep the banking system going. Even the autos had to come out of a second group, another $75 billion. And that's what led people accurately to say, look, you just bailed out the bankers. Now, we didn't bail out the bankers to help the bankers. We did it, as Chris said, to keep the economy from collapsing. But that was the failure. At that point, we lost the opportunity to use some of that money to alleviate foreclosure. And let me just say about foreclosure, not everybody who was being foreclosed upon was a worthy recipient. Some people did lie and did take money out. But there were some who were victimized. There were many who were victimized, and they should have been helped.
And, you know, the vote, I hate to bring up a sore subject, but it doesn't pass the first time. It doesn't do it. It takes the Dow Jones Industrial Average falling 2,700 points over a couple of days to focus attention.
Among the Republicans. Remember, the Democrats, and this was, people ask whatever happened to bipartisanship, and the answer is Barack Obama got elected, and the Republicans never gave him the cooperation we gave to George Bush and his administration. And so the Democrats voted heavily for it in the House. Republicans voted heavily against it. And it was only after the stock market dropped 700 points that some Republicans began to hear from their constituents that they better turn around. So on the second vote, a majority of Republicans still voted against it, but enough had switched because of that pressure.
I mean, it's almost not irrational on the part of those Republicans to be leery of voting for the bailout. I mean, they got in trouble in their elections that followed.
But that's always a safe bet. I mean, you know, Richard Shelby and I are good friends, but he'll tell you, he never votes for a bailout. Whether it was New York City, whether it was Chrysler, whether it was this thing.
Always say no to bailout?
Start out saying no. You're not going to get too much trouble by voting no on these things.
The general way that we characterize that in the legislative body, when there's something you know should be done, but it's unpopular, you vote no and pray yes. Yeah. And the Republicans in the House thought, you know what, we're in the minority. Let the Democrats, even though it was their administration, there were many who just figured, let the Democrats take the rep.
And I don't know, Bonnie, I think Bonnie and I agree on this thing. I don't think we ever did anything in my 30 years in the Senate as unpopular as this, and yet as more important as the TARP bill.
You're sticking with that, even now?
No, absolutely. Oh, we not done that, I mean, what we didn't do well enough, and I blame the administration for a lot of this here, it always should have been a consumer bottom-up approach to this thing, about consumers in the country. And we too often, the language was always about stability of the institutions. And consumers kind of came in last.
Well, you spoke up about that in some key meetings, saying that that's what this should be about.
Yeah.
What was the reaction?
So to this day, it's despite the fact billions have been returned, consumers have been made whole in many cases here, it's still seen as a bailout of financial institutions. And why did more people go to jail? You get that question almost daily.
The point is, we did write that, and we wrote the bill. So we wrote in authority to do, we wrote in authority to limit compensation to the top people. Right. We wrote in the requirements that they not just repay the loan with interest, but we have the warrants that Chris mentioned in case there were profits. We wrote in a mandate to do something about foreclosure. And here was our dilemma. At that point, the Republicans were running the show. And you can't run a program from Congress. You can authorize it. You can give them the tools, but you can't wield them yourselves. And the alternative for us would have been not to give them the authority. I mean, the idea would have been to give them the authority and have them use it. But giving them the authority, even though they weren't going to fully use it in ways that we like, was still a better choice than not giving them the authority at all and having it crash. And that was our frustration. And it's the limitations of being in the legislative body. They had their hands on the tools.
There's some remarkable stories, though, out of this. I got to share with you. That night of the vote, I asked everyone to vote from their seats in the Senate, which we rarely do. And I went around to members who were up in 40 days, Democrats and Republicans.
Who were for re-election.
I had 75 votes. Yeah. I knew I had 75 votes. Senator Kennedy was very sick, and he was going to be the missing vote that evening. He wasn't back. So the vote was 75 to 24. But I went to Democrats and Republicans and said, I'll never repeat your name or use your name, but if you want to vote no on this thing, I've got the votes. If I needed your vote, I'd tell you I did. And I'll never forget Gordon Smith, Republican from Oregon. I said that made him the same offer. He said, great offer. He said, but I've got to see a constituent in the morning, and I don't know quite how I explain it, to be honest with you. I said, well, who's the constituent in the morning? He said, I'll never forget this. He said, the mirror.
The mirror. He has to look in the mirror.
and as a result, he lost 40 days later. Bob Bennett ultimately lost in Utah's. Kay Bailey Hutchinson, you point out, in Texas.
My
castle in Delaware.
In fact, what happened?
Four years later, they were still, this was a major campaign ad against anyone who voted for it.
You mentioned, you know, that maybe it was rational. Yeah, it was rational in your own self-interest. Chris and I knew this was not the most popular. I think my staff said, you know, I had my toughest race when I first ran for office in 1980, but my second toughest race was my last race in 2010 because we had passed a wonderful bill and we had done these things, but it was very unpopular. And the problem is, it's hard to get political credit for averting disaster. I mean, I complained about it. My staff actually made up one copy of the bumper sticker I said I wanted to use. They were afraid I would use it. It said, here's what I want to run on. Things would have sucked worse without me. But you don't get any credit for that. But on the other hand, to make your point, Chris just told you, that reaction was a major piece of the rightward movement of the Republican Party because Republicans who voted for the legislation suffered badly in 2010.
And more conservative people replaced
them. And as Chris also pointed out, you know, things don't go away. The 2010 Republican primaries, I think, terrorized an awful lot of Republicans, and it's a major factor in the Republican Party having moved that way to the right.
Part of this idea of it's so deeply unpopular, but Senator Dodd, you point out, you think it was crucial that you did it at the
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely, no question.
But what part of do you want a second Great Depression or not wasn't made clear to people?
We tried, but they didn't believe it.
Or maybe you couldn't, though, because people were afraid of rattling the markets.
No, by then.
But even worse than that is, it's one thing they didn't believe it then. We're both blessed and burdened with no memory in this country. And it's an asset and a liability. And when you go back and tell people, 5 million homes went into foreclosure, $13 trillion in national wealth evaporated, 27 million people lost their jobs, iconic institutions, investment banks, commercial banks, credit unions, savings and loan disappeared or were nationalized or merged. it was an incredible set of issues that came to me. And people even today, you have to remind them of that to understand how much trouble we were actually in. And then, let alone today, which is harder.
And it's hard to persuade people, as I said, that you were going to have disaster. Americans are thought well of the economy. By the way, there's one other factor on the foreclosure. And yes, we got the worst of both worlds on foreclosure. I think the reaction to that gave us two political phenomena, the Tea Party and Occupy, because there were some people who were furious because we did some help for people. At least we talked about it. The Tea Party grew out of, what's the guy's name from CNBC, said, we need a Tea Party. How dare they help these people with their mortgages? Nobody helped me with mine. So we had people on the right upset because we were talking about helping people avoid foreclosure. And then you had people on the left angry because we didn't help people do that.
But the Tea Party turned this into an electoral movement. Occupy Wall Street was more ambivalent about signing up people.
Be careful with that line. You got a great line.
Yeah, I will.
No, I'd love to hear the line.
Here it is. And I said, here was the problem. We had two movements came out of it, Tea Party on the right, Occupy on the left. And our problem was that the Tea Party registered to vote and got involved in primaries and took over the Republican Party. And the Occupy people smoked dope and had drum circles. And I will tell you that members of Congress are much more attuned to people who register and vote in primaries than to people who sit around smoking weed and banging on drums.
But they figured that out now, on the
finally,
left side.
Finally, but they didn't then. I was on the Bill Maher show with a representative of Occupy. They didn't have representatives, a person from Occupy. And I said, well, one of the things that troubled me was I never saw a voter registration table at an Occupy site. She said, well, we weren't into that. I agree that I think the left has learned now the lessons of 2016 and elsewhere, so people are going to be turning out. That's one of the things that I hope is going to be transformative this year.
Well, let me turn up the heat on this particular idea. Without the great financial crisis that you two helped fight, without the crisis, do we get President Donald Trump?
Well, look, I agree with Barney and others who made the case that it begins, if you want, we argue it began with Vietnam. What it could be, I think, frankly, the health care debate was had more to do. That month of August in 2009, a year later, it was obviously didn't spring entirely there, but they really, the town hall meetings that took over, and no one was talking about the financial reform bill in September of 2009. It was really all health care.
So by a year later, we were talking health care.
Yeah, but I remember, we're also talking about a time when, despite the fact that there were Republicans in the House and Senate who were obnoxious about these bills, the fact is that people like Judd Gregg and I worked on the TARP legislation together, helped draft it. We were working with the Bush administration, with the Secretary of the Treasury, putting this together. That image, 75 people in the Senate actually vote for TARP, despite how unpopular it is. The Congress was demonstrating what it was capable of doing with good leadership and resolving problems. So the image was not all negative. You really were demonstrating your capacity to deal with a major problem and come together in a bipartisan way to do it. That wasn't a bad message for the country.
First
of all, I think Chris is, in what he said, is very powerful and should be underlined. But here's the problem. There was a sequence. The TARP, the bailout, as it was called, was very prominent. Unfortunately, we never got as much attention for what followed in that sequence, which was the toughest financial reform and regulation since the New Deal, because healthcare took it off. The media can only focus on one big issue at a time. And if we had the perception that the crisis was followed then by reforms to clean up the thing, we might have been better off. But healthcare intervened. So you never got, Chris has noted this, when you ask people what they thought about the financial reform bill, it's the most popular bill that's passed in a number of years. But you got to ask them. They don't bring it up because it was not as prominent. And as to Trump, I do think, look, he won by so little. We got Donald Trump because of less than 100,000 votes in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. Given that, a whole lot of things could have taken it. So I think the answer is yes. But here's the trap I don't want us to get into. It wasn't the crisis that was the cause. It was the failure of policy that led to the crisis. And this is the frustration for us. It was the right-wing policy of not regulating, of refusing to do regulation, of Greenspan refusing to use the powers he got. So the conservative philosophy brings on the crisis, and then we as Democrats being responsible step up and try to resolve it, working with some Republicans, and then we get blamed for it.
And we never could have, on the financial reform bill, if you had ever tried to pass it a year before we did or a year after, it never would have happened. The window opened in that one moment, and you even have enough sense to go through the window and get as much as you can done, or it closes very quickly. And it wouldn't have opened up again, in my view.
That was former Senator Chris Dodd and former Congressman Barney Frank, Democrats, and authors of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. The second part of our in-depth conversation we'll post tomorrow. We'll delve deeply into the law, the attempts to dismantle it, and the safety of our systems today, both economic and political. We've posted videos and a full transcript of this interview on our website, and we have a whole bunch more coverage from our Divided Decade project. It's all at marketplace.org.